And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack.
Dean Haglund, happy 10th anniversary to us.
Wow. Who would have guessed 10 years of this? Oh, my God. How looming.
Weekly.
It's a celebration. It's a
free
celebration.
Weekly entertainment that we have provided the masses, the legions, every...
Every week. Every week without...
Fail with some ish. Fail ish. Yeah. Sometimes we fail. No, don't kid yourself. Right. And sometimes it was less entertaining than others. A couple times we've needed to have people help us by pinch hitting, but still, rain or shine, 10 years, 520 episodes. You know that I was told when I became a podcaster there'd be no math, but still, as I count them, that's 52 episodes a year, and there's 52 weeks in a year. So we did it.
We did it. Yeah. And I got to doff my cap to you, sir, for doggedly pursuing this, even though I bugger off to other countries, we run around the world doing other projects, and yet there is still a commitment to the free podcast, which, you know, you hear so many comedians go, oh, I'm going to start a podcast, and they do like 2 months worth and realize how much work it is, and then say, oh, well, the hell with that.
Like Mark Hirschhorn once pointed out, we are the final ones from that first wave of podcasting who are still doing it.
I know. Is it our tenacity?
Well, we're hoping one of these days we'll get it right.
See, that's the thing. It's the very zen of the way Henri Cartier-Bresson taught photography. Just take a same picture of a cup over and over again until you get it right. And so here on year 10, here's crossing our fingers.
Well, you know, the other thing about it is that it doesn't get any easier. And I don't mean from a content standpoint. I mean from a technical and logistics standpoint. And I think actually the bizarre reason that it gets more difficult is that we actually care more about those things than we used to. I mean, some of these episodes... that we put up that I'm going to talk about as we count down today, our top 10 most memorable episodes of Chilpack Hollywood Hour over the last 10 years. Technically, they're terrible, and it was like we didn't care. We were just building a barn and putting on a show.
Oh.
But I will say this.
I was running tech, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's kind of, but it still didn't. Look, there's a couple episodes where it's still the technical effort. You pulled some all-nighters to get the show up.
Yes.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that. But the one thing I will say about this, and I think you will agree with me, when people say 10 years, does it feel like 10 years? No. It feels like 1 month shy of 10 years.
Well, see, if I could just take a month off your life, that'd be good.
No, it would add one month. Wouldn't it add? Wouldn't I get an extra month?
Yeah.
I don't want to take a month off.
I guess.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Because there's
not 10 years in a month.
There's no way I'll finish my to-do list if you take a month off my life. And God knows.
That's terrible.
God knows. I'm getting every last item crossed off. So, Dean.
Fantastic.
Do you want to start? I mean, we don't even need to talk about criteria. What makes an episode memorable? I mean, I think it'll just depend on the episode. So, do you want to start? What's number 10 for you?
Yeah, because there's no particular order. I mean, how do you sum up 10 years with our diversity and how we've traveled and also use the podcast as a way to check in on what we're working on. And also, how about our great friends that have come and been guests on the show? Should we start there? How about some of the great guests?
Wherever you want to start. I'm going to go in reverse chronological, quite frankly. I'm going to stick to reverse chronology. When you talk about the most memorable, and I think you'd probably agree with this, or maybe not, but when it's the handful of my most memorable, there's no real way I can rank them. Like, that's right. The fourth most memorable. That's the fifth. I'm going to count them down, but I'm going to do it in reverse chronological order.
Right. I see what you're saying. Well, I can't just do that off the top of my head. So let's just put some of our most hilarious guests on first, huh? Who can forget the time Gary Anthony Williams came over and we had a chat with him back at the old Eastern Columbia?
I certainly cannot forget that. In fact, if you did not mention that, that would have been one of mine. That was without a doubt.
Is that right?
Yeah, it would have been one of mine. It was without a doubt the most I've ever laughed during an episode. In fact,
it's true.
That was, I believe, year 5 of our show. It was episode 216. We were early in to year 5. And was, to this day, well, this is what memorable means, I guess. To this day, very, very few days go by without me thinking about something that was said in that episode and laughing. I mean, I was crying so hard. I was laughing so hard at that episode.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund in the offices of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder known as the Eastern Columbia Building. This is your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with my co-host, as always, Mr. Phil Larness, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Dean Haglund. You're welcome. I actually feel today it's kind of my Chillpack Hollywood Hour because we have a guest who is one of my favorites.
One of your favorites.
You know, I mean, among other things, in a long and successful... Don't interrupt me.
I am agreeing with you. I am your favorite. I'm not just one of them. I am your favorite.
In a long and storied and delightful career...
Delightful.
I happen to also be a star of maybe my favorite television show of all time. So we have lots to talk about, and we're welcoming Mr. Gary Anthony Williams.
Gary Anthony Williams, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you both. I had no idea that you were such a fan of Cousin Skeeter on Nickelodeon so many years ago.
Well,
he was a puppet, but I was real. And he talked to me.
First of all, I'll be the judge of that.
Okay, all right.
Wait a minute, Cousin Skeeter?
To have patterned so much of my mannerisms after Cousin Skeeter as I've done, it really is quite a thrill.
That is a thrill.
How did the two of you meet? Let's start there.
Wow. Let's go back.
As we said before we started recording today, we were so young.
we were so young.
And we knew it, and we relished it. We relished our youth.
All right. Well, I think I'll start, interestingly enough, Dean, with an episode from just a handful of weeks ago, less than 2 months ago, episode 511 of year 10, where we counted down the top 10 things that occur to us now when we watch our documentary, The Truth Is Out There. I thought that was a fascinating conversation. And I thought really interesting the ways that this film continues to work within and without the psyche of both of us.
Without the psyche. Yeah, my psyche's been removed.
Well, I mean, it's working on our psyche, but also we're seeing ways in which some of the things we were going after reflected the world in prescient ways. I feel like that film is only more meaningful today, you know, the movie. The truth is out there. I think it has a lot to say now. We were a few years certainly ahead of the curve, the conversational curve anyway. And our discussion of it was interesting because we really hadn't got into a lot of depth, even in conversation with each other, in quite a few years about the movie.
And I said this on an interview, you know, I was sort of flippant about it, but it was also back from my arts and context classes at university, that truth, they would ask me, oh, is the truth out there? And I would always say, well, it is, the truth is subjective. So it's something is true for everyone. But everybody's truth is different.
It's relative to our unique experience.
Absolutely. So
and
it
perception.
Is also therefore
and perception.
And perception.
And what we perceive is what we experience, and what we experience is what we believe. Yes. Although there are people who refuse to believe what they experience, and therefore they don't perceive it. All right. What's your number 9, Dean Haglund?
Well, speaking of the truth is out there, that arduous journey across the world as we filmed at various conventions and stuff like that was quite a year. And And I remember now the exhaustion at the end of it in London. And perhaps my favorite episode is you and I sitting down at a British pub and just getting liquored up for an hour after the final day of shooting of The Truth Is Out There. And how much that episode I enjoyed and how much of it I don't remember saying. So I would say...
Yeah, that's actually, interestingly enough, that was our third anniversary show. It was episode 156, and it was an anniversary show that combined us in studio in Los Angeles, the offices of Rational Exuberance, and segments we recorded at London's Lyceum Pub.
I'm Beverly. So, hey, Dean, you're a comedian. You have a joke. Well, I got one. Guy's on a bus. And a nun gets on, right? And she's gorgeous. She's absolutely stunning. And she sits across from him, and he's just staring at her. And she's, you know, so beautiful. And she goes, I'm sorry, sister. Sorry to bother you from reading the Bible, but I just have to tell you, you are the most beautiful woman I have ever seen in my life. I think you're stunningly gorgeous. I just have to let you know. And she looks up, and she goes, oh, thank you. And she continues reading the Bible. And he's still obsessed. He still stares at her at the bus ride. He goes, I'm sorry to bother you again, sister. I'm sorry. I really apologize. But I just seen that you were so gorgeous. I was wondering if you would consider having sex with me. She goes, no, I'm married to the Lord. I vow chastity. I can't. No. Completely offended and shocked. She gets up and gets off the bus. And the bus driver turns around. He goes, I'm sorry, I overheard that conversation, but I happen to know that that woman, that nun, gets on this bus every single day. And I also happen to know that every morning at 6 a.m., she goes down by the meadow near the convent where she lives to pray. Perhaps if you approach her there, you would have...
The bus driver's helping him.
You would have better luck than on a bus.
And seducing the nun.
Yes, well, thank you very much, he says, and he gets off the bus. Next morning, 6 a.m. in the meadow. Mist is on the meadow. The birds, morning birds, are twittering. And in the distance, she sees her on her knees. And he thinks to himself, oh, wait, the bus didn't go so well. I got a better plan. He says, arise, sister, for I am the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'm here to sow the holy seed within you. And the nun says, my Lord, I am worthy. And I am accepting, but unfortunately, it's that time of the month, so I'm afraid I'll have to take it up the ass. And he goes, yeah, that's okay. So they have sex. And afterwards, he's smoking a cigarette. And he's going, you know, sister, I have a confession to make. I'm not really the Lord Jesus Christ. And the nun says, well, I have a confession to make, too. I'm the bus driver.
So that's...
See how much fun that is?
That's your number nine. My ninth most memorable episode is episode 396. It comes from year eight. Another very funny guest, though this was a show that we thought would be a lot about comedy, but because of some of the things going on that week in the news, it became every bit as much about race relations. And it was when my friend, the great stand-up comic and comedy writer and documentary producer and actor, Sully McCullough, visited.
Oh,
and
yes.
And not only did it become a conversation about race, but Sully and I found ourselves confronting head-on in conversation with each other for the first time ever, a rather traumatic experience that we shared and yet never discussed that took place when we were both coming of age in Cupertino.
Do you remember the driving around in my white Buick Skyhawk and we were playing with toy guns?
I do remember that.
So we're in Cupertino, streets of Cupertino. We were Cupertino Vice, as we called ourselves.
Right,
Cupertino
Vice.
Crockett and Tuck.
And that was popular at the time.
That was
Don't
very popular.
Yourself. We're wearing, you know, neither
espadrilles.
Of us. No socks.
Oh my gosh.
And so we've got these cap guns and stuff in the car. And like he said, we were always filming stuff and always using stuff. We had so many props and stuff. A woman apparently calls
the
cops.
Police.
To say that a young black man is holding a young white man hostage in his car.
Yeah.
So we get to my parents' house.
literally pull into the driveway as soon as we are out the car, hit with floodlights. We're blinded.
Right.
I can't see anything, but all I, you know, all I see as I'm being dragged away to safety.
Right. Right.
Are people.
And keep in mind, I'm 118 pounds now. So then I was about 98.
98.
Yeah.
So very threatening at 97 pounds.
And
in Silicon Valley.
Yeah. I mean, not even a.
Who's what?
Stepping away from the car,
right?
You know, any kind of thing. No, I mean, and these guys were. They were wearing flak jackets.
Yeah, they were serious. It was a real deal.
Yeah, I think.
And it's funny. Like I almost blocked most of that out.
Okay, you pushed this on. It's horrible.
Yeah. And that's how a lot of people. Here's a little black moment here.
Right.
That's how a lot of black people deal with real atrocities of race. We block it out.
Well, you know what I mean.
This is why. Just keep it moving. Because if you let it stop you, it will.
Well, this is why I wanted to bring. Bring this up because I'll tell you what my memory of it was. I remember seeing my friend, you know, pushed down onto the ground.
Right.
And I'm getting pulled away and I'm screaming. That's my best friend, you know?
Yeah.
And they're not listening to me or whatever.
Right.
Because they're, you know.
Because they've been tipped off.
Well, yeah. And of course, as we know, hostages often start to identify with their.
Right.
So that was just proof.
Right. I'm a very charming.
Yeah. You're Svengali.
I take someone hostage, I take them hostage. They love it.
The way you brainwashed me while at the same time being forced to listen to my favorite Ray Parker Jr.'s greatest hits tape.
Right. We're letting it all out on this podcast.
But anyway, that's what I remember, and I don't remember us talking about this anymore. But the overwhelming sense of shame that I felt that there was nothing I could do to help my friend.
Right.
And that I didn't want to ask you about it because I didn't want to ask how you felt or anything like that because I just felt so ashamed.
Well, you know, what was funny to me is I remember feeling like a different kind of shame that we were just playing and having fun and being creative.
Right.
And how even that is perceived as threats.
Right.
As threatening, as dangerous.
Right.
And the funny thing is like that has happened numerous times since then where, you know, I've been.
Wait a minute! You're riding around with young boys in cars,
playing with guns. Yeah, it's my thing. It is my thing. I can't let it go.
Okay, what's your number eight, Dean Haglund?
I always am thrilled when our opening has the sultry tones of voiceover and good friend and voiceover actor and actor John K. Steele, who says now from somewhere in America, it's Chilpack. And then you have to cue him Hollywood, and then he says Hollywood Hour. And so it's one of our classic road trip stories. I believe the sun was rising on Highway 99 as we were driving up to Sacramento to do a morning show, if I recall, Good Morning Sacramento, in preview of, I think it was The Truth Is Out There.
We were showing it at movies on the big screen in Sacramento, and we had the chance to appear, but the movie was that night and the morning show is like crack of dawn. And
I know, so we drove. Did we drive all night?
Yeah, we drove. Yeah. We left at I think 2 in the morning. It was something ridiculous like 1:30, 2 in the morning, and we hit the road and we made it there in no time. And
right, because there's no traffic. It's not 5 hours at that point. It's 2.
And, I thought about this, but the reason I thought about it was actually because other people have told me it's one of their favorite episodes. So I'm glad you had it because, I honestly, it's all a little bit of a blur to me.
From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood
Hour.
Dean Haglund, what does it mean that we are somewhere in a secret location?
Why, it means, Phil, that we are in the parking lot of IDEXX Laboratories here in the City of Trees, Sacramento, California, or West Sacramento, California.
It is, in fact, West Sacramento. We are just outside the security gate for the local CBS affiliate.
And we'd be inside the security gate if we weren't 3 hours early for our morning show. Good morning, Sacramento.
Good day, Sacramento.
Good day.
Yeah, we arrived early enough for good morning, Sacramento. We are supposed to be on good day, Sacramento.
Right.
The 10 o'clock hour is all for us.
Right. Why couldn't it have been good afternoon, Sacramento? Because that would have been closer to our screening time.
Google Maps said 6.5 hours from a certain historic building in downtown Los Angeles to the CBS affiliate here in West Sacramento. And instead, it was not even 5.5 hours. And I had, of course, padded an extra hour just in case.
Right. But now that gives us the opportunity to sit in a parking lot and wait.
Where public parking is prohibited.
Right.
But as you said, this is a podcast emergency.
Right.
All right. My, I guess we're at 8, right? Yeah, number 8 for me. I'm going to say another episode from year 8. And that is episode 370. We recorded it poolside, and our special guest was our one-time youngest listener, Erin Petrulis. She was visiting Los Angeles. She was going to be moving to Los Angeles eventually, and our youngest, one-time youngest listener became our youngest guest.
I was still living in England, so I was like 15 or something.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm 22 now.
Look at you. Just graduated from?
Columbia College, Chicago.
Wow, yeah. Look at that, with a degree in?
Musical theater BA with a minor in gender studies.
that comes in so handy.
It really
musical
does.
Theater. So often you have trouble with gender identification.
It's important.
It is true.
It's really going to be that gender studies aspect that serves her well when she's working as a waitress here.
Bartender.
Bartender's good money in Los Angeles. Don't kid yourself.
Yeah. And really, we ought to embrace the idea of welcoming onto the show as many bartenders as possible.
Yeah, for
because
sure.
I remember when I was...
You never know when you're going to need a drink.
Yeah, well, any time now.
There was a time when I never had to pay for a drink in this town, and I would like that to happen again.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How would that happen?
I feel like that, of all the things that I've done in my career, that... That's the thing that lets you know you're in a good place in your career is if you don't have to ever pay for a drink.
Yeah, I don't have to pay for drinks, but that's not why.
See, I've missed out on all this. I've always paid for drinks, and I've paid for everyone else's drinks.
Oh, well, you're a good person.
It's my credit card on the line.
Skybar was one of the real big, and now Skybar, does Skybar even still exist?
It does still exist,
but
it is
so passe.
Well, yeah, it's one of 1,000 typical bars.
And really, you hit Sunset Strip now on a Friday night, a Saturday night, it is nothing compared to the traffic downtown, traffic in Hollywood. But Skybar was really, really a hip place. And when you first moved here or first came here?
I think, well, I was on The X-Files, so I had two places going at the same time. So I had a place in Hollywood and a place up in Vancouver. And everybody goes, oh, you're going to see a lot of celebrities at Skybar. You got to go. Oh, man, see celebrities. And, like, you know, you're fresh from Vancouver.
Yeah, and so even though you're on a hit show, that's exciting because you grew up a fan of Hollywood movie making. And you got to do that.
Got to do that. And then I go into the Skybar, and it's like...
You sit at the bar, right?
I sit at the bar, and then I say to the bartender, "Hey, man, I heard there's lots of celebrities. Who's the celebrities here?" And he goes, "Dude, it's you." I'm like, "Well, I could see me anywhere. This is a waste of time." The saddest, bloodied. I never went out to a bar again after that.
What's your number 7, Dean Haglund?
Well, I love always going to the poolside on those shows. We've had numerous poolside shows, I think.
Sure.
And so I had, well, I had written down just poolside, and then I was trying to determine all our guests we had up there. And, of course, we did one without the guests. We did one just you and me getting sunburnt. Do you remember that one? We didn't put sunscreen on.
I remember
on
the sunburn.
The top
sure.
of our feet.
Sure.
Yes. So I believe that was our very first attempt at recording poolside.
You know, we may have to come up with a new name for this show.
That's right.
And we thank the people who have been making suggestions. Our favorite so far, which we can't do for a couple reasons, because it lowers us in the alphabet. We're at F right now, and if we're going to make a move, we want to make a move more towards A.
Right. For those of you who are throwing suggestions to us, we want something that is high, like between A and F in the alphabet, because that way you show up easier in the iTunes and
right,
all
when
the
people
searching.
Do the search engines
for that.
And the backstory for anybody who missed it, you got a cease and desist from a man, and I'm going to be go easier on him this week. But a man, but a man who does a show called The Heart of Hollywood, and he did a cease and desist.
I don't think it's the heart; it's just Heart of Hollywood.
Heart of Hollywood, saying that we, we're either trademark infringing and we're creating brand
confusion.
All these things, and I said this to someone the other day. You know, if this guy had contacted you and said, "Hey, you know, I listen to your show. Really like what you're doing. I do a show called The Heart of Hollywood, and I'm having a little bit of a problem." And if he'd invited us to be his friend,
yeah,
you know what? We would have absolutely been yeah. Nice, I totally understand. You know, and I'm not bagging on this guy for being a total douchebag, as much, even though he was, as much as I really hate the climate that we live in, where you have to start with threats of litigation,
yeah,
rather than just like being cool with someone,
just saying, "Hey, man." You know,
how about inviting people to be your friend?
Start
there.
Why not start at a, you know, how do you do, instead of guns a-blazing? You know, this is sort of, I got to say, somebody pointed this out in England, and I thought it was quite interesting observation, that American folklore, the whole justice system, is based on two guys facing it down with guns drawn. It's this O.K. Corral showdown, right? And that now that we've taken guns and replaced it with lawyers, we do the exact same thing. We don't greet each other. The strangers come to town and you throw lawsuits at them. You don't actually try to say, "Hey, how you doing?" like your show. It is the immediate thing of legalities. And I met the inventor, by the way, who has 69 patents on the software where you are text messaged when your shuttle is coming or when your plane's delayed or anything like that.
Yeah.
He has now all these lawsuits against FedEx, UPS, who are not paying his licensing fee for the software he's created. They have said, "Look, man, the justice system is no longer about justice. It's about resources. And we have the resources to crush you, your lawyer, the law firm he works for,
of course,
and the other law firm." And so there's not even a sense now that some guy can come up with an idea, patent it, and get ahead in the world.
I'm worried about the fact that you just pulled the soapbox out from underneath me and got up on it yourself.
Well, I'm going to keep the poolside theme going. And from our first
we
pools,
should do more poolside.
From our first poolside, yeah, but whose pool? I mean, you're in Australia. Do you have a pool there? Because I don't have a pool here. So,
no.
I mean, what are we going to do? We're going to each go to public pools in our respective cities and Skype? Yes. That'll be fun.
Yeah, the Annette Kellerman, she was a famous Olympian, and she opened an aquatic center here. We can go for no reason and just podcast from poolside.
Number 7 for me is another poolside show, but rather than it being one that you just chose where we had no guests, I would hazard a guess that this is one of the shows we did with the most guests. It's episode 329 from year 7.
Uh-huh.
And it was our poolside rap party for the Lady Killers. We had so many guests. We had Jamie Kaler, we had Christina Grantz, we had David Dean Bottrell, and more. And that's a really fun episode. We're talking about the movie we just finished shooting. We're drinking. It's hilarious.
Here he is. It's the man of the hour. It's the host of the rap party, the lead actor. This is Mr. Jamie Kaler. Jamie, welcome to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
It's finally. Honestly, it's one of my career milestones that I've always dreamed of. This, having a Gap commercial, and that's it. Just those two. Just
not the signing show at the Beverly Garland, which is just walking distance from here?
You know what's funny? I mean, I'm only a block away, so a lot of times I'll just bring a stack of headshots and just stand in the lobby. And I'll just, when people check out, I usually do it like Sunday morning because I know a lot of people check out typically Sundays.
Yeah.
And so I'll just go down and I'll go, hey, what's your name? And they'll go, Tom. And I go, hey, to Tom. Thanks for stopping by. Good luck.
And that's $20, please.
And $20. Yeah. But I have a deal with the hotel. They add it into the bill, and I give them a $3 kickback.
Jamie Kaler, who do you play in The Lady Killers?
My character's name is Pete Martell.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're playing Pete Martell, technically.
I'm Pete Martell, but, yeah.
And what is Pete Martell a police detective?
Oh, he's a police detective. And he, I feel like he's the instigator of the game. I mean, he's trying to relive his youth. It's really, I've written pages and pages and pages of backstory for my character, because that's the way I work.
Is it?
And yeah, and each line I have notes. Like, usually I'll take one line in a scene, and then I'll backstory it. But here's my acting technique, which is totally opposite, and then they gel together. What I do is I learn my lines, barely.
Barely, yeah.
And then what I do is I wait till it gets quiet in the scene, and I say line one. And then I let some other stuff happen. And then when it gets quiet again, and I'm pretty sure no one else is supposed to speak, say line two.
Line two.
And I just go through that motion until I'm out of line. And then I usually here's the trick. A lot of people at that point will just bail
right?
And start to head to craft services.
Yeah.
I don't. I stay until the director yells cut.
Oh, see, that's smart.
All right. Number six, Dean Haglund.
Well, since we're talking Lady Killers and all of that, there was an episode of The Lady Killers. I mean, I'm sorry, an episode of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour shot during the filming of Lady Killers. We had to, and I don't even think you were part of it because you were behind the camera, busy at work in the high school location, and I was recording, I believe, Lily and Bert. And
yeah, several conversations. Yeah, it's really good. It's actually, I might have had it on my list if I was a part of it. but I thought because if you were talking about like 10 episodes I enjoy listening to the most, that would be on it. But memorable,
right.
I don't really have any memories of it, so I couldn't put it on my list.
Right.
So I'm really glad that you did. Yeah, and I remember.
Yeah, so
and
it's
I remember
one of my favorite memories.
Yeah,
when you weren't there.
but I loved how everybody who came out of the room recording with you like just had such a bounce in their step afterwards.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm talking to Alex. He's in our movie.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here. So you're playing?
I am playing Allie.
Mm-hmm.
I am a detective.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
And tell me more. What does this detective do?
This detective has a partner that she, I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say.
That's right.
That's
we
right. We don't want to give everything away, but just so you know, Allie's got some things going on.
That's
she's got
awesome.
Some things up her sleeve.
So how'd you get involved with this whole thing?
Oh, this is amazing. Phil and I have known each other for a good 12 years.
Wow.
We have tried working together about 4 times.
On different projects?
On different projects, and something always came up. Either I got something else, or Phil had to change dates, or, you know, what else happens in Hollywood. But and it almost happened on this one as well.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, because we had dates set and I was like, I'm sorry, Phil, but I'm actually producing my own movie and don't think I could do it. So Phil was awesome enough to change the dates for me multiple times.
That's fantastic.
Yes.
So I think that brings me to number six, my number six.
Yes. For those who are keeping count, yes.
And that would be episode 140. I'm jumping all the way ahead to year 3 of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And this, we alluded to earlier, because you had to spend a long night. It's one of the episodes you had to spend a real long night figuring out how to get from the XD Cam software to... a form that could be edited and uploaded in a hotel room in Spokane. But it was a conversation we had while driving across the Canadian border into Idaho, driving through Idaho our way to Spokane. It included, I think, a phone call to Peter Davenport, a very mysterious, cool dude who runs the UFO Reporting Center, about where and how we would meet. And he was, you know, we were going there still with the back of our minds going, this guy might stand us up. He might just freak out at the last minute and stand us up. But he did, and he was great. But the rest of the conversation also was totally cool. I mean, we had this great conversation about the late night wars that were suddenly back, because I think this was the Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno late night thing was really exploding. And the Haiti earthquake, right? Wasn't it the earthquake in Haiti that was so disastrous, so, you know, led to so much destruction? And we had this conversation about how when you're on the road, when you're involved in the production of a movie, how it's odd because you'll see these headlines and you'll see this footage and you're in this weird bubble where you go, well, I know that that's horrible. I'm intellectually seeing that it's horrible, but I'm emotionally, I don't feel affected by it.
But it's been interesting, has it not, to be traveling and to be working on not just one film, but two films while this is going on. I mean, I don't know about you, but like what I alluded to earlier, you know, I watch this, I watch the reports, I see the footage, and it's really strange when something like this happens when you're in production and so much of your energy and your focus has to be around one particular creative enterprise that day, mm-hmm. and then the next day, and the next day. You see these things, and somehow they don't register on the same level, because it's almost like I don't live in that world right now.
Right, and also we're catching the Canadian perspective on that. So it's how Canadians are faring, how the Canadian military relief effort is going. So you have that perspective as well. Plus, you know, half the time in these hotels, I don't even know where the heck CNN is on the channel dial. So I, you know, those would be, if I were at home, I would like totally know what channel to key in and just sort of leave that on and follow it. And
well,
that's
it's
not
a little
happening.
Bit, I guess, like being like, you know, your sister and her boyfriend. It's a little bit like being off grid.
Yeah.
And yet still being connected.
Yeah.
Like absolutely. We know what's going on, but we're off grid in a really strange way. We're not around people who are talking about it.
Absolutely.
We're not. I mean, it's you, me, and Roman in a car traveling over the Rockies, not getting news reports while we're doing it. So what are we talking about? We're talking about, hey, maybe we can find the Conan O'Brien monologue on YouTube.
Right, exactly. When we get to a place where there's a Wi-Fi hotspot, you know? And so it's interesting that, yeah, we're by going through the Rockies, you sort of appreciate information differently in that it comes to you in packets, but that also then you're not also mainlining it like a heroin addict.
All right, episode number 5. Dean, what's your fifth most memorable episode?
No, you know which one I... well, most memorable or, like, most complicated, I believe, is the Mayan calendar episode. This is December 21st, 2012, when... and the little backstory for those listening, I had to drive through snow and rain from Vancouver with two Dobermans... And we arrived. I just dropped off the rental car just as you arrived. So we basically got back to Los Angeles with maybe an hour to spare before we started a 24-hour.
28.
In 28, a row, 24
28 hours. 28 hours. But we took a four-hour break and handed off during the night to, I think, Alex Lefchuk and Siren FM, and then to Ethan and Combat Radio. But we did, 28 hours,
Right. And I believe, as you said at one point, I'm mid-conversation and my eyes roll in the back of my head and I fell over asleep. Just like, I just basically run out of juice. But this is the first hour is the one that remains at the podcast. The other 27 hours lost to the ether of the electronic age. And, so
and that's probably for the best. It's probably for the best. But you know what's funny about this is, do you remember where the idea came from for doing that podcast?
Well, it came from everybody's panic of the Mayan calendar ending.
Right, but
I don't remember the actual seed of that.
I know the specific moment of when and where we decided we're going to podcast live during the end of the Mayan calendar. We're going to ring in the end of the world with your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. It was while sitting in that Lyceum pub at the end of shooting The Truth Is Out There, while we were really drunk, and we were talking about how many people kept bringing up the end of the Mayan calendar, and that's when we decided to do it.
Phil, why don't you take us through the next 27 hours? In just a nutshell, what's going to happen here?
We are going to make sense of what the Mayans knew. What did they mean by their calendar? What
what did they mean?
Why did it end?
Right.
That'll take about 15 minutes.
Yeah, uh-huh.
With the rest of the show, we've got music.
We got music?
We have a special guest in studio. We have people who will be calling in, Skyping in. I think we're going to let Alana handle all those interviews.
Yes, yeah. I've got some fantastic, interesting, great people calling.
You know, Alana, we can't thank you enough for actually preparing, because what we never do is prepare in our show.
Now, I know Alana kind of in two different capacities. One is because she also is a frequent contributor to Alex Lefchuk's Midweek Drive.
Oh, right. Oh, shit. He's
in
still
the
on
UK.
The phone. Hello? Did he hang up? We were on
you
the phone in London.
You just put him down. You just put him down.
I did.
It's like, I like that you keep looking to the camera. We're going to have to remember that that's on a delay.
Yeah.
So otherwise, people are going to get for 28 hours us commenting on how we looked just a few minutes ago.
Well, hey. No, the delay is only a five-second delay for swearing and inappropriate.
So,
I don't know.
So Alana,
we're not allowed to swear? Wait, I usually don't swear unless it really. But there's sometimes you really need
Sean
that
Sean is saying
word.
Swear away.
Just swear as much as you can.
He's saying swear as much as we can.
As much as
Thanks,
we want.
Sean.
It's okay. The end of the world, people.
It's not. Okay, let's start the show with this. I'm sick of hearing this is the end of the world. Why can't this be the beginning of the new world? Because you know what? I just drove down from Oregon. I spent 15 hours in a car. People were jerks. They were cutting each other off, flipping each other off. The traffic was the worst I've ever seen in Los Angeles. It was a miserable experience. I want that to end. I want that miserable thing of humanity to end. I want there to be a new world where we are more positive, where we've gotten rid of all that negative energy and the car rage and all that.
So my number five is another road trip episode.
Oh.
Not nearly as long as the road trip to Sacramento, of course, or from Calgary to Spokane, Washington. But it was a drive that we took to Malibu. Then we got into this really interesting conversation. I think the first time and one of the most detailed times we ever discussed the concept of corporate risk management, how risk management is being applied to everything in the creative arts and how nothing creative ever comes out of risk management. Because I think this was when we were going to interview Lee McCloskey for The Truth Is Out There. I'm pretty sure of that. And that's episode 129, and it was year 3.
Well, that's
but
sad.
You know where their emphasis was. These are precarious financial times.
Absolutely.
So let's get someone who's a good soldier and a good businessman.
And can deliver that. And that's the thing. I'm sure they've already paid for all these other guys to develop it, and you're now sitting in a deficit financing situation where you've got to get something up on screen just to pay for those other three guys that you already had run through development.
I love when a theme will suddenly, for our shows, just through conversation, will suddenly emerge. And I guess it's sucking the bones dry is the theme, because, you know, last week I was staggered. We know that Hollywood loves remakes and sequels, and we've talked ad nauseum about why. Even I was struck within the last week by how all the movie news was about sequels.
Yeah.
And just a staggering amount. And it's because it's risk management, is it not?
Yes.
You know, the rights to Terminator series being auctioned to a new company so that the old company could get some money to get out of bankruptcy, maybe, and so that the series could continue.
Yeah.
You've got a news announcement that Peter Berg has dropped out of director of the new Dune remake.
Oh.
First of all, Peter Berg dropping out as director of something, how is that news? Secondly, a Dune remake?
A Dune remake? How do you make that?
Sir Ridley Scott, who we knew was coming back to the Alien franchise.
Yeah.
A franchise that started 30 years ago. He did make the pronouncement that this new Alien sequel is a prequel set 30 years before the first one filmed 30 years ago. And when asked, well, what would that mean? You know, like, what year is that? He really didn't know. Because he didn't know when the first one was set.
Right.
Which he directed.
Specific year.
Right.
But it would be how that alien got on that planet and sent the SOS, I would hope.
Casting concluded on Mad Max 5.
Hooray.
Without Mel Gibson in it.
Yes. Too crazy.
Although we are in Malibu, where, yeah, quite frankly, I was hoping... You know, there's expired tags on this car. I was hoping that we'd get pulled over so that I could go all Mel Gibson on the Malibu police.
Call them sugar tits?
Why would I use my nickname for you and belittle it?
Not in front of the audience.
Oh.
Okay, what's your number four, Dean Haglund?
Well, who could forget the joy when we went up to Vancouver and popped over to fellow lone gunman Tom Braidwood's house, where we were filming interviews for The Truth Is Out There, of course, and then had an extended lone gunman episode.
We didn't have a lone gunman episode. We had an extended episode of the Chillback Hollywood Hour featuring the first reunion of all three of you since the show had gone off the air.
That's true. I guess it was the first time. I guess, you know, we met... here and there at a con or two, but it was the first time we actually sat down without a full agenda in front of us and had a chance just to chat and reminisce and discuss.
Like you had never, you guys had never, you'd never compared notes, for example, on your feelings on 9/11, having had done the pilot that was so evocative and prescient of what was to come.
That's true.
We were in Los Angeles, Tom and I, and we were supposed to fly home September the 11th.
You were?
Yeah.
We were filming the 10th,
yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah. We were just filming the 10th. And I got a phone call in the morning, like 8:30 in the morning, for the guy who was supposed to pick me up and drive me to the airport saying he wouldn't be doing it today because somebody had flown a plane into the World Trade Center. And I thought, that's not very funny.
And then I thought about it,
and I went, no, wait a minute. I know these guys. They had never have any idea who they're picking up, so it's not like he knew ahead of time. Yeah. Oh, that's the guy who plays Byers on The Lone Gunman, and I've seen an unaired version of the pilot.
Right.
So I can make this joke. So at that point, I realized, and then my second thought was, oh, my God.
You know? And then you turned on your TV, and you saw it for real, and you phoned me about 8:45.
Yeah, yeah.
Woke me up and said, you better turn on your TV.
Turn on the TV. We're not going home today.
How'd you guys get home?
We drove.
Yeah, we waited 3 days. They tried to get us out for 3 days in a row, but the planes just weren't flying. You know, it was the weirdest thing. I mean, the day it happened, it was just, well, anybody who was in LA
stopped.
It was just dead.
Yeah.
You know?
Nothing was open.
You don't realize how much sound there is in a city until it's not there.
Right.
You know, there were no planes. There were no cars. I mean, there was an occasional car drove by the hotel.
And in fact, the sounds, if you did hear a sound, it became scary.
Yeah, exactly.
It freaked everybody out.
It was just, it was really, really weird, and it was really, really creepy. And we waited. They tried, you know, and basically we contacted them I think it was twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. They were trying to get us out, but it was a Monday, wasn't it? When it happened?
Yeah, because I had to fly. I was supposed to fly to a comedy club. My bags were packed for a noon flight.
Yeah, and by Thursday, there's still no flights getting out, and we got together and talked about it. We said, you know, let's get the hell out of here.
Well, we wanted out. We actually believed at this point that the borders were going to be closed.
Yeah.
Any aliens in the country, like Canadians, were going to be arrested and put in a camp somewhere.
Yeah, we were.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we were concerned that, and we really were. We were genuinely concerned that.
Quite frankly, it would be about time.
Exactly. That the borders were going to be shut down. And,
James Cameron.
So the next time we talked. We talked to Fox, said, look, just find us a car that we can take to Canada and drop off in Canada, because that's what we're going to do.
So that was episode 139, year 3, The Lone Gunman Reunion.
Look at that.
And it's an episode that might just get a sequel at the end of May. Is that not true?
That is true. I guess so, right? Why not, since we'll all be there?
And where is there, Dean Haglund?
Oh, yes. We'll be at Dallas May 26th through the 28th, I guess, the weekend, at a convention, the name of which is escaping me, but you're going too, so you might remember it. Is it UFOCon? Or
I don't know either.
Yeah. So anyway, if you're in Dallas between May 26th and May 29th, the 2017, by all means, pop over to some convention center.
And you just might see us there, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, my number four, Dean, is the panel that we did in Berlin at Berlin XCon. Yeah. I was sick as I've ever been, and yet it's one of our best shows, I think. And it's episode 127, and again, from year three. Boy, I had a lot of year threes. You had several year threes. It was a good year.
Yeah.
But because of how hard it was for us to keep doing the show, I think that's why it was such a good year, because we were traveling so much, and it was just one other thing to do. And if we were going to do it, I felt like we really made sure either we had a lot to get out or we had a real desire to enjoy it if we were going to be doing it.
Do we have any chill packs in the audience? Chill. We don't? Chill. We do, right?
They're owners, okay, yeah. Good. They have chill packs.
I want to hear about this. No, not proud owners of the chill pack.
Oh, not proud owners.
I want to hear about the chill packs, this organization.
Group. Yeah, that they had the t-shirts made. That I still have mine. Thank you. Yes. But now they're all wearing Gunman Mondo Bizarro shirts.
As am I?
As are you. Look at you. What size is that? Because some people wanted a medium.
Extra, extra large.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, I'm very big.
Yes. You're big everywhere. I mean, globally, you're well known.
That's true, I'm very popular.
I'm very popular globally. That's
I think the word we're looking for is creepy.
Yes.
So what is your number three?
As you said, we travel around and we do panels. And, of course, one of my favorite every year was going to Dragon Con, the largest. I think it's more the larger. It's larger than Comic-Con insofar as Comic-Con is a lot of Hollywood producers and pushing product, whereas DragonCon is fan-based.
Yeah, it's the largest fan run. It's the largest fan-run pop culture convention anywhere in the world, I think.
Absolutely, and there's tons of conventions. I mean, tons of signing guests, tons of people. It's over four hotels in Atlanta over the long Labor Day weekend. And and we did a panel, you and I, there, which some of that panel appears in The Truth Is Out There, but that one to me was really a lot of fun. You and I answering questions at the X-Files tract, as they call it. Different shows get different tracks, and then the guests come in, and this was our you and me at the Dragon Con panel.
I remember hearing a story about Saddam Hussein trying to rebuild the Wall of Babylon or something.
Oh, that's right.
And they're fighting in a different dimension. If you could elaborate on that for us, please, that would be amazing.
Oh, that is amazing. You know that story?
I remember hearing a part of it, but I wonder if you could expand on it.
Right.
Fill in
this
the details.
Is the conspiracy behind the Gulf War. The real reason why we went into Iraq after 2001 wasn't a fight for oil. It wasn't to stop Saddam Hussein. It was apparently to get the Sumerian text out of the museum, to loot the museum, because Saddam Hussein spent the entire 90s, when it was an embargo, collecting every written tablet of Sumerian text, which is the oldest language known to man, because it contained the myth of Gilgamesh, and it also had the instructions to open the gate of Ishtar, the fiery gate. And this was a portal to another dimension, which, according to the myth, whoever walked through this gate would have unlimited power and unlimited knowledge. So this coincided with a mysterious 10th planet that comes through our solar system every 25,000 years and offers a jump in human consciousness, which they've just found another planet coming towards our solar system way beyond Pluto that apparently has a rotational orbit of every 25,000 years. So anyway, the point is that we went in and we rushed into war March 2003. We dropped 350,000 troops, the entire 7th Cavalry Tank Battalion. Embeds were placed in certain places, but other divisions you didn't hear about. And of all of those soldiers, the number that went into Baghdad was 25,000 troops, 650 tanks. And the rest of the story was that everybody was bogged down 40 miles south-southwest of Baghdad at the Euphrates and Tigris River, which was the location of Babylon. Because as he was collecting the Sumerian text, apparently Saddam Hussein thought he was the reincarnation of King Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible. And he actually has a plaque in the Babylon restructure that says King Nebuchadnezzar in the reign of Saddam Hussein.
My number three is actually a two-parter. It is episode 122 and episode 123, the two episodes immediately succeeding Dragon Con. And it was a two-part conversation we did with Vince Gilligan at the Breaking Bad production offices. Yeah, it was
right,
so great.
Allied Chemical.
Yeah, so we got to talk about not only Breaking Bad when it was just starting to break big, but we got to talk about his contribution to The X-Files, to The Lone Gunman, movies that he wrote like Hancock. It was great, great fun, and you got to give him a chill pack on camera.
That's right. I remember you, you know, busting his balls about Hancock going.
And you were terrified. You were terrified, and then by the end of the conversation, he went, yeah, I it's all right. I agree with Phil.
The nature of the twist in Hancock, and we won't give it away, but it basically is a two-act structure, the film, and it twists in the middle.
Yes.
And
60 minutes, right?
And
on the mark, right?
The problem that I have with it is that everything that leads up to it gets back to that word authenticity that we have before.
Right.
We get to know these characters and see this world, and then through the twist, that's pulled out from underneath us. And so that right there I have a problem with. But then the second thing is that your writing is so strong in that of all the X-Files writers, in fact, you never seem to fall into the trap of telling rather than showing.
Yeah.
And Breaking Bad is...
Are you aware of that?
I try to write good.
Breaking Bad is a testament to showing, not telling.
Yeah,
especially because the protagonist himself has such a hard time.
He doesn't say anything. I mean,
very good, very astute. He does not share anything with anybody, even himself.
Even himself.
And you can't even believe how much we're getting to see what we're seeing sometimes on the show. And that moment in Hancock, the big twist to me, is all about the opposite. It's all about telling, not showing.
Yeah.
It's all about exposition. And yes, that backstory revealed in the exposition is kind of interesting.
I thought so.
But unfortunately, more interesting than anything that comes in the second half of the movie.
Yeah. No, a lot of what's wrong with Hancock is definitely my fault. I'm not going to say otherwise. But, you know.
What happened?
But I mean, what...
Well, it's just that, you know, the best thing I can say about the whole thing is TV versus movies. And movies, and again, I can only speak from a point of view of a writer. I've never directed a movie. Movies are just so unfun
for writers.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak to my own experience. There's a lot of really smart people making movies. A lot of real good intentions. And boy, the producers on that movie, some of the smartest guys I've ever sat in a room with. And Will Smith is a great guy, and a very, very smart guy. Very smart, but at a certain point, with movies, there's so much lead time on them, and there's so many cooks, and the writer is the low man or woman on the totem pole.
Right.
What is your number two, Dean Haglund?
Well, so many of our guests are pre-booked, but some of them aren't, and there was the surprising announcement on one of our episodes that Lily was appearing on The Price is Right, and we were to watch it. I think she couldn't give it away, right, till it aired. I believe this was recorded before it aired, but I can spill the beans now. She won a new car.
Yeah, well, so I'm not sure. Are we talking about when she said that she was on and she couldn't tell us? Or are we talking about the episode where I think John Lawler, who does our theme song, sang our song live? And on that episode, you and Lily got into a discussion about the game that she won called Safe Crackers.
It's fairly easy to get on the show because you more or less need to hijack the interview.
Ah.
And most of Middle America who comes to be on the show freezes up and gives one-word answers,
like,
don't really want to be on the show. They just want to watch. And so for the few people who sincerely want to be contestants, all they need to know is that they need to hijack the interview and act really perky and talk a lot and say clever things and may or may not be a guarantee that you get on.
And what is your profession?
An art historian.
Ah, that was good.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I majored in art history in college, so.
Right, so if they asked you any bizarre questions about...
They did. They didn't believe her, so they asked her to
prove
it.
Do contrapposto. And I did a contrapposto pose.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Wow, so they knew all the terms and...
Yes.
The producer knew contrapposto off the top of his head?
Yeah, he said art history was his favorite subject, so we bonded right away.
Look at that. Of course he did call you up.
And he said, you know, do you watch Price is Right as an art historian? He said, well, you're probably, you know, at work during the day. And I said, DVR, man, it's the 21st century. He goes, well, what's your favorite game? I said, Safe Crackers. He said, why? And I said, because when I originally heard the name, I thought it wasn't like to crack a safe. I thought it was like at physical crackers that you eat, and some are safe and some are poisoned.
That's how you thin out your guests. Eat just the safe crackers. Don't eat the poison crackers. Shouldn't we call this poison crackers? No. Let's call it safe crackers.
Good. Okay. Well, that's it. That's, you know, is the glass half full?
Right. No. I think we have to call it poison crackers so the audience knows not to eat the poison.
Is that guy half?
We just call it safe crackers.
Is that guy half dead or is he half alive?
No. Seriously, call it safe crackers, and then the poison's a surprise. Okay, I'm with you on that, Chuck, but I don't know. It just seems dangerous not to call it poison crackers.
Number two for me of the most memorable episodes of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. The most memorable episode I think we ever did, for me anyway, with a guest, episode 94. It was in our second year. One of the first shows I think we did there at the offices of Rational Exuberance, high atop the historic core of downtown Broadway. Our guest was none other than the... estimable, peerless Tucker Smallwood.
Now, many of these stories you have written into essay forms. How long have you been writing? You referred to your blog, but how long have you been writing essays?
I began suffering from PTSD in the early 80s, and I pretty much spiraled into a suicidal point of being. And by the late 80s, I was ready to check out, and I was very fortunate, and I got a lot of help from someone who was very special. A psychologist who had been to Vietnam before he got his training.
Wow.
And he understood. He only worked with veterans and policemen.
Hmm. And is he through the VA hospital system?
Well, no, not so much. I was working with veterans in the VA system, but I was hiding out from my own problems.
Right.
Some fellow veterans saw that I was in trouble. They gave me a book called Long Time Passing by Myra McPherson. And I read those stories of interviews between veterans and their families and their children and their parents. And I said, my God, that's me. That's me. I recognize myself in their problems. And so I asked for help. Vic DeFazio gave me back my life. Interestingly enough, he was flying back and forth to Russia before the Soviet Union fell, working with their psychologists, because the Afghanistan soldiers coming, the Russian soldiers coming back from that war,
the 1980 war,
had the same issues that Vietnam veterans had. It was a guerrilla war. It was an unpopular war. There were drugs involved. There were fragging.
Interesting.
And the dynamic of PTSD is, you know, pretty universal. Human beings, by and large, are going to have some sort of a reaction to the horrors of war.
Wow. So the process of becoming writing these essays came out of this.
Well, Vic, my shrink said, you have these memories and you need to write them out. You need to write about them and explore them. And so I began writing. I had tried early to write fictional things, and my, you know, I love good fiction, but my voice as a writer sucks in fiction. I look at that and say, that doesn't ring true. That's bogus. And I found the form of an essay suited my sensibilities. I could look at every single word and say, yes, that is so. That is exactly the way it was. That is exactly what I believe. And if it wasn't, I could delete it or erase it. So I began writing little essays about memories that I had. And over time, these grew.
All right. That brings us to number one, Dean. What's your number one most memorable episode? I feel like you have an interesting tie at number one.
Yeah, I got a tie. And the tie is between, well, the shows, and it's, I'm going to say shows plural, because there's two shows that we lost that somehow disappeared from our computer, never to hear again. And the one in particular was You and Me in Malibu, or Santa Monica, during the AFM. I believe we're at the Lowe's Hotel, and we're beach, oceanside, at an outdoor cafe restaurant. And we recorded what I thought was a really, if I recall correctly, fascinating show into the insight of international distribution and film and what was going on at the American film market, where you were still president of Cinema Arts International. And I thought it was insightful, fun, intelligent. We had lots to offer. And somehow my assistant back then, Chris, was in charge of processing that show. And that's the one that disappeared. So that sits in my memory as my number one most memorable show is the one you can't hear. So in lieu of that, it's a tie for the one you can hear, which is our very first episode, episode number one, how it all started.
We were going to discuss the Motion Picture Association of America, the rating system.
The rating system.
And in light of the recent death of Jack Valente, the longtime head of the MPAA and lobbyist for the film industry. Before I get to that, however,
yes,
noticed that a book that seems to be selling fairly well is available at your fine booksellers everywhere.
Yeah.
A book by the name of... what did I do with my... Oh, here it is. Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone from Stuart Stanyard, which I believe features an essay by Mr. Dean Haglund.
Mr. Dean Haglund wrote a little something personal about my experience with Twilight Zone. And
to have starred in all the classic episodes that you did, like Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, where you were the thing out on the wing.
Okay, it wasn't really about that. It was really how Twilight Zone has influenced another generation of actors and writers and performers in sci-fi, and how, you know, he wanted that kind of breadth in his book that I'm glad is out now. And how did you know I wrote? Did it actually put that on it?
I know people. I know things.
Okay, awesome. And what did they say about
subconsciously? I knew that you had written something.
See, because all essays are from the subconscious. If I learned anything,
so Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone by Stuart Stanyard is available for purchase right now.
And if I learned anything from college, it's that all essays come from the subconscious.
That's do you want to say it one more time?
My number one most memorable episode, also in year one, 17 episodes in, our first show ever with a guest. And that guest was Philip Newby. He, of course, would be dead by episode 89. Of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. But he really wanted to come in. He said, will you ever do shows where you invite guests? And I go, I guess. We're not really planning this thing out. But he wanted to discuss the depiction of time.
I was talking with Phil about films that, and I hadn't really had a name for it or had a really fully formed theory about it or that sort of thing. But I was talking about how films that have a set amount of time. What Phil dubs time lock. A film that takes place over a certain amount of time, like 48 Hours, like Escape from New York, like Nick of Time, which was not good, but it has the time element.
The idea.
And how a lot of times these films that just take place like over the course of an evening, over the course of 24 hours, something like that, or maybe a couple of days, are very appealing to me. That even a film that I don't particularly wouldn't be that excited about. Like I remember seeing the trailer for like 200 Cigarettes and not really being so thrilled about it. But then I found out that it was kind of like an all-night party or kind of like people going around all night. And that just made it that much more appealing to me. And I then wanted to see it more.
Right. And that's sort of the thing that, you know, if I were to recall my Sid Field workshop on screenwriting, that not that I'm pitching. What?
If you were to have taken a Sid Field workshop, because I've written with you and you haven't taken that workshop.
Oh, you bastard. I have, and I've broken the rules. I'm a maverick. To heighten the drama, you actually lay in a ticking clock, as it's known, that to put the stakes up and put the pressure on the
hero to actually defuse the bomb. You have a timer counting it down. Otherwise, he's got all afternoon to cut the red or the blue wire.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
That always adds the tension that you want in your drama.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, you know, there are films, and I sort of have I feel there's still kind of a subdivision. There's the ones where it is the counting down, like Escape from New York, like 48 Hours, whatever, where, you know, you really have a certain amount of time to do this, or, you know, right, something's going to blow up.
Die whatever. Hard 3.
But then there's the films that just take place over, like Dazed and Confused, which takes place over a day and a night. You right. don't necessarily know it's going to be a day and a night, but it just kind of turns out that way. And for some reason, it's very satisfying to me that way, as opposed to if it took place over a week or a month.
Right, except Before Sunrise.
Yes, Before Sunrise, After Sunset.
Those weren't satisfying to me.
I know.
I hated those movies.
Oh, Richard Linklater.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just looking that up, and I know you hate Richard Linklater.
Yeah.
However, which one was the second one?
After Sunset. After Sunset.
I liked that movie a lot.
What?
I didn't like the first one. I liked the second one.
Frankly, I didn't go see it because I so hated the first one.
Second one was great. I was stunned because the second one got great reviews,
what?
Even from people who didn't like the first one.
Wow, that
because
would be.
It's such a mature piece of work.
Did I have to? Do I have to reevaluate my Lincoln
and
hatred?
And it's interesting though because it really did have a ticking clock.
Which was?
Which you're not really aware of at the beginning because it's like, wow, we go back to our lives once I get back on that plane. And when they met all those years earlier and were young, you think you've got all the time in the world.
Right.
And now they're aware that you get pulled apart, that
you
things constantly change. So here's two people really feeling the need within this sudden time lock to leave nothing unsaid.
Well, that brings us to the end of year 10 of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I say we begin year 11, Dean. We crank it up to 11 with next week's show, and we preview the 10 episodes of the next decade that we're most looking forward to.
I'm looking forward to the one where we get it right.
All right. That's been 10 years of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next
Great.
Week.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. In Los Angeles. Downtown Los Angeles. In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Wow. Give it up, people. Look at that.